Thank you, Susan, for that introduction. I also think, just with respect to the Einstein Fellowship, it's such a wonderful and unusual sort of opportunity because it doesn't require any output. It doesn't require you know already where you're going to end up. And in this case, as luck would have it, it did turn out to end up somewhere. So that was, it's just wonderful to have the chance to fail, just in case. Good. So it seemed that, in retrospect, 2012-2013 was a good year for the hypocrite, the spineless, the shallow, the venal. It was a good year for the zealot, the fanatic, the freak, and the fool. Rachel and I were working together. This is Rachel Wiseman. She's going to pass around something now. Rachel and I were working together, and it seemed that wherever we looked, whether it was in literature, in history, in the newspaper, and say nothing of closer to home, we found excellent examples of hypocrisy, compromise, and other forms of lack of integrity. And also other forms of integrity maintained under extraordinary circumstances or in extraordinary ways. Now, of course, our attention was caught by all kinds of failures of integrity. This is the stuff that makes the headlines. Corruption, hypocrisy, plagiarism, fabrication, selling out, compromise. These aren't hard to find. And then there were the rarer cases of integrity maintained, which also drew our attention, but maintained at the cost often of all the niceties of social life. But perhaps even more interesting for us to notice was the rhetoric of integrity, and especially its abuse. We can largely tell that integrity still matters to people by the constant and varied forms of calling out its absence. While some of these callings out are appropriate, many are contrivances. They're tools for excluding opponents from discussion. One form this takes are the accusations, or more often the insinuations, of hypocrisy, of compromise, of selling out, or inconsistency, used deliberately to undermine the authority of someone's voice so as to dismiss their validity or the validity of their claims without actually acknowledging them. Another form that this takes, more a part of ordinary exchange than of political discourse perhaps, is the relegation of anyone of outstanding integrity to the realm of fools, madmen, or connivers with secret ulterior motives. We are, it seems, surprisingly adamant that we will not allow an actual case of someone who genuinely has integrity in an outstanding way. And we will not admit the possibility of that someone who appears to be showing outstanding integrity is in fact doing just that. Then there's the curious invisibility that the lack of integrity has to the person acting without it, and often to those around them. If someone lies or deceives, they generally know that they're doing so and have a phenomenology of what they're doing as of lying or of deceiving. And similarly with theft, fraud, and of course the more violent sins. But generally somebody acting without integrity doesn't notice that they're doing that at all. They will have some perfectly straightforward and innocuous understanding of their action as one in which the opportunity for integrity or compromise does not even arise. And then because both Rachel and I work in the increasingly coercive and corrupting institutional context of UK higher education, we are interested in the institutional structures and social contexts that undermine integrity, make it not just impossible to maintain, but make it vanish altogether as a quality of persons, their work, and their shared world. What happens when integrity gets replaced with transparency as the cardinal umbrella virtue of institutions and persons' work within them? What, if anything, has been lost? So we found ourselves with a web of questions related to integrity. What does it do to a person to have integrity? What does it do to them to lack it? What effect does it have on others? What qualities of character and circumstance enable one to maintain integrity, and which undermine it? Do institutions have integrity? And if they do, does that somehow cut against maintaining personal integrity? Does the integrity of something created bear any interesting relation to the integrity of its creator? What would we do without integrity, and what do we do with integrity? What should we do with integrity or even, let's say, without it. After all, it seems to make people pretty disagreeable to those around them. But whatever the answer to these questions, it became obvious to both of us very soon that integrity is too important to be left to the philosophers. So here's what happens if you hand integrity over to the philosophers. First, they're still strangely wrapped up in Socrates' what is X question. And so pretty much the only question that philosophers put is, but what is integrity? And then they have a perverse way of going about answering the question. Anglophone philosophers, at any rate, will first ask you for your necessary and sufficient conditions. Then they will seek counterexamples to throw at it until they've shown that the most appalling people have integrity and that the best lack it. In fact, this is one of Anglo-Saxon moral philosophy's more disreputable uses. Sorry, I should say it's one of their uses, disreputable use of the argument ad nauseum. So this is, in fact, how I was introduced by somebody of considerable integrity, as it happens, to the question. As an undergraduate, he asked me, my tutor asked me, but why couldn't you have a Nazi with integrity? And you'll notice, if you have the misfortune to read any of this literature, that somehow the name of this Nazi that might be have integrity is always Himmler. I don't know why. I kid you not, that's really what goes on in the literature. So if you hand the topic of integrity over to philosophers, they will say that they will in this way demonstrate that integrity is not even a virtue, and in a case there are no virtues. And in fact, it's not even a character trait, and by the way, there aren't any of those either. Thereby, I think, utterly and culpably missing the point. So what we've done is we have thrown the question of integrity open to the world. It's an invitation to come together with others who want to think hard and to think seriously about the value of integrity and the cost of doing without it, its place and its out-of-placeness, its demands and its extravagances. We need historians who can illuminate the changing nature and place of integrity in popular discourse, political theorists who can think through the nature of the political realm, its integrity, and its relation to individual integrity. We need social scientists who look at the effects of institutions and of mores on people's actions and self-conceptions, psychologists who study how groups of people create, enforce, and challenge norms amongst themselves, literary and cultural theorists and art historians to share their thinking on making things with integrity in both senses of that phrase. And we need people willing to simply draw on their own experience of being in all the various contexts studied to think about what integrity and the lack of it means. Over the course of the past 9 months, we have found some of these people with whom we try to address some of these questions. And you can see on the pamphlet a little that hopefully has been circulating around how far we've come so far. We're gradually building a community of people interested in continuing the conversation using the Integrity Project website as a resource and a place of exchange. And we're continuing to find opportunities to encourage others to think with us and speak about the topic from a variety of directions. And that's what we're here today to do. So I'm very pleased all of you have come. Thank you for that. I'm really looking forward to what all of you have to share with us about your own thoughts on integrity, and in particular on saints and madmen. And so I'm going to start by sharing with you a little bit of my own thoughts about integrity and madness. The madness comes in at the end, if it hasn't already been on display. Now, as the analytic philosopher's latest refinement on the definition of integrity dies the slow death of 1,000 counterexamples, one thing we notice is that, for some reason, their candidate necessary and sufficient conditions always have a devil of a time distinguishing between the person of integrity and the fanatic. Well, for some reason, I think my analytic colleagues might be starting in the wrong place and going about it in the wrong way, and yet it's not accidental that the fanatic keeps turning up wherever we look for the person of integrity. This reflects our lived experience. So, where should I begin, and how should I presume? Shall I say, integrity is what Job has when his world collapses around him and still he refuses to curse God. Integrity is what Socrates has when he rejects any plea bargain that would require him to leave off philosophizing and refuses to flatter his jurors that they are cleverer and more powerful than they are so that he might get off more lightly. Integrity is what Antigone has when she insists on a proper burial for her brother who took up arms against their city instead of standing silently by as Creon decrees the body be left for the dogs. Whatever it is that they have, we admire them for it. We might wish that we had the same, though doubt whether we would prove up to it when it came down to it. We would not want them to lack that quality, not for their sakes nor for our own. Yet we might wonder whether we would really want to be friends with them. It seems too dangerous, too awful. Yet for such a person to call us friend, to count such a person as a friend, would be profoundly heartening. But notice, Job's tenacity earns him the contempt of his wife. Socrates' oddness causes Alcibiades violent consternation and annoys Callicles no end. The man will insist on being so odd. Can't he just be normal? And Antigone's sister Ismene is dismayed by her sister's fiery mood and offers to at least keep discreetly silent about Antigone's intentions. To which offer Antigone replies, "Speak out, please. Silent, you'll be more hateful to me than if you told everyone what I did." Now, integrity as a quality of persons has a longer history in English language popular moral discourse than in German. In fact, I'm not sure how I would have this conversation in German. And I wonder whether I could have it in French or in Polish or in Swedish, and I wonder how much that matters. Does one need a word in order to collect phenomena together in a certain way, in order to make certain experiences then possible at all? The Greeks, I know, had no word for integrity, yet this hasn't stopped them profoundly shaping our own thinking about it. So in the 18th and 19th century English public discourse, English language public discourse, there was a bit of a run on integrity. You can see evidence of it all over tombstones and memorials of the period. It was how any man would want to be remembered, and Samuel Johnson includes integrity, of course, in his dictionary of 1928 or 68, depending on the edition. But the interest in integrity hardly began then. Where Luther's 1534 Bible has Job maintaining his Frömmigkeit, the King James translators in 1611 have him holding fast to his integrity. By the time of the King James, integrity was already in use for maybe 200 years to mean something like a kind of unbrokenness or intactness of person, of character, or of purpose. The first English dictionary of 1604 has only about 2,500 words or so. They are, according to the subtitle, mostly Greek, Latin, or Hebrew-based words, which are collected especially for assisting ladies, gentlewomen, and other unskillful persons. Among its 2,500 words is integrity, with the meaning pureness and innocency. So clearly that's integrity for the ladies. Integrity is used already in 1548 to praise Henry VI, along with his liberality, his clemency, and his courage. But attaching the word to Job's reaction to his misfortune, and doing that in the most widely shared book in the English-speaking world, that all the non-readers, the illiterates as well as literate people, are going to have access to. This must have contributed significantly to its currency and connotations in English language moral discourse since the early 17th century. It made Job, for English speakers, a model of integrity. Now, I think it sounds a bit strange to us now. Meaning and usage has evolved enough that it sounds a bit strange to say Job held fast to his integrity. Nevertheless, I think the translators of the King James Bible were on to something. Through the literal sense of untouched and unbroken, they were picking up on a long Platonic Stoic tradition of thinking about a kind of unity and wholeness of person that's not given, but an achievement, a kind that sticks out conspicuously and often antagonizes people, a sort of unity and wholeness with which both relies on interpersonal conditions and social context and often stands painfully against those. So what kind of wholeness is relevant here? What is it that Socrates had that Antigone shows or that Job holds fast to? I want to introduce two rather different approaches to trying to articulate that wholeness that's characteristic of integrity. I'll call the first one preconditional unity. I know that's a barbarism, but I won't hang too much on the name. And the other one I'll call emergent unity. Both of them return to the core meaning of integrity as intactness and bring out why such a thing might be immensely important to us, both in ourselves and in others, and not just some kind of fetish. So the preconditional unity that we might think of as characteristic of integrity, I take from a contemporary, recent 20th century moral philosopher, Bernard Williams. Now, Bernard Williams says, integrity is not a virtue. But he's much more interesting than my other English-speaking colleagues who deny that integrity is a virtue. He says, integrity is not a virtue because it's a precondition for human agency. Integrity, says Williams, lacks both the motivational force and the characteristic thoughts that are typical of the virtues. So if you're going to say integrity is a virtue, you have to have a theory about what kind of thing a virtue is. And Bernard Williams has such a notion of what a virtue is, and integrity is not like that. Kindness, for instance, is that virtue by which one tends to see the world as opportunities for being kind and to thereby be moved to act accordingly. So similarly with courage or justice. But integrity, as I alluded to before, has a curiously invisible quality, both to those who have it and those that lack it. And while it makes perfect sense for someone to think to herself, I must try to be kinder, it doesn't quite sound the same for someone to think to himself, I really must try to have more integrity. We might even wonder whether someone capable of having such a thought is in fact capable of the thing itself. Now, this difference between integrity on the one hand and courage, justice, or kindness on the other may arise because integrity is prior to any virtue. It does not describe a quality of character, but it describes that which enables one to have a character at all. In order to act meaningfully, one has to have a sense of being somebody, perhaps even a sense of who one is. But in order to have such a sense, there must be commitments. Williams prefers the word projects. For commitments or projects with which one identifies strongly, and in such a way that to violate or abandon them would leave one disoriented. Identification with some such core commitments or ground projects is what orients one in particular actions and in organizing one's life as a whole. Staying true to them is what holds a person together. Now, such a view can be and has been criticized as a complete account of integrity, not least because of the frighteningly neutral character of the ground projects on account of which one counts as having or lacking integrity. But taken simply as some observations about integrity, its role and its importance, rather than as a philosopher's definition with necessary and sufficient conditions, there are several aspects worth noting. And here I'm going to offer three. On this account, integrity is related to that wholeness of character and person which orients one's outlook, enabling one to make sense of the world and so of oneself, to make sense of one's actions then and choices, and to make sense in action. Second, although described in individualistic terms, integrity is an individual quality only had in a social context and in relation to others. Having projects and being committed and the meaningfulness of a life that this enables only makes sense in a social and interpersonal context through people living together. And finally, more formally, if one wants to speak of consistency or inconsistency in character or action, there must be something that establishes that with which one is or fails to be consistent. We can use integrity to refer to that which makes it possible for actions to be evaluated as consistent or inconsistent at all. And so one might call this preconditional integrity or preconditional unity. Okay, second kind. Let us take another way of characterizing the wholeness of integrity, one which locates the relevant unity at the opposite end, so to speak, and thus gives a different explanation of why integrity does not look like the other virtues, and yet would be something of vital importance to human life. Rather than being fundamental and prior, integrity is what emerges when all the virtues are taken together. Choosing integrity in 1611 to describe the kind of wholeness Job maintains was, I suggested, a choice influenced by nearly 2,000 years by that point of Platonic and Stoic thinking about the unity of person, its value, and its relevance. If we turn to look at the Stoics themselves, we see that the vital unity of the psyche that might be called integrity is unlike other virtues because it is, in a way, a quality of those virtues. On the Stoic account, different aspects of virtue can be characterized in their different familiar ways. But actually, all we really have is just virtue and the lack of it. Any single virtue, say kindness or justice, will not be present until it's in the presence of all the other virtues. Now, this can sound like just the sort of high-minded optimism that Greek moralists are notorious for, until we realize that we're not discussing the accumulation of different things which only reach their magic perfection, Aristotelian-wise, when sound judgment comes in to use each to limit the others. Rather, on the Stoic account, there's just one thing. There's one good, virtue. Or, what is the same as far as they're concerned, living in accordance with rational and providential nature. Once one has that, we could break up the different aspects in which this of the manifestations of this, of feeling and behavior, and we could file them under familiar categories. That kind of virtue is action we call justice. That kind of virtue is action we call kindness or courage. But these can't help us. But these virtues cannot help but form a complementary unity, since they are various expressions of this one thing, namely living rationally according to the rational good order of the universe. Integrity is just what the fact of their original unity is called. It emerges as a quality of the whole, hence emergent unity. The virtues cannot help but be unified in the sense of all pulling in the same direction, and that direction is towards something which itself is ordered for the best. So is a whole. One aims to make oneself accord with the integrated, the providential unity of reality. And it follows seamlessly that one's actions and emotions reflect this unity, for there's nothing left in a person's soul to pull them in another direction. Now, there are good reasons we're not all Stoics. The fatalistic flawlessness of the arrangement of the universe is not something many of us have much appetite for. And that our appetites and aversions should be fully amenable to reason can hardly be taken seriously by most of us. Still, the Stoics offered our most plentiful supply of exemplars of integrity, and I could have spent 45 minutes going through different Stoics known throughout the ancient world for their outstanding integrity. And I think their view captures important features of our inherited thinking about integrity. Again, I'll choose three. The person of integrity is intelligibly good in other ways. Integrity is incompatible with being vicious. And yet, it isn't thereby just a generic term interchangeable for an all-round decent sort of guy. Integrity has to do with unity and wholeness, and not with its insipid brethren, consistency and coherence. That unity worthy of the name integrity must be one which is reality-oriented and aiming at the good. And, as Plato already saw, the person of integrity is not weighing up alternatives and balancing competing desires in a series of moments of choice that make up a life. Integrity is something one does with one's whole soul, and for that reason, we can expect a kind of clarity and harmony within the person of integrity from which, in many cases, action and appropriate feeling just follow as a matter of course. So these are two different ways of capturing integrity as intactness. And you can see how they approach the area of concern from opposite directions. The first, I think, we might think of as a kind of minimal bottom-up approach to the unity characteristic of integrity. I think this is terribly important to hold on to in one vital respect. There is a special kind of harm in violating that in a person, that what I was calling preconditional integrity, that commitment that makes life meaningful at all. There's a special sort of harm in violating that in a person, a sort of harm for which we lack an adequate name. But if we can identify this foundational integrity as the precondition for personhood and agency, or better, the precondition for a meaningful life and meaningful action, we can at least begin to appreciate the depth of harm done by forcing someone to compromise or violate their integrity. But while it indicates why it might be so vital to an individual to maintain integrity, it does not even hint at why we generally should value integrity in others, and in particular, why we deplore hypocrisy, venality, cynicism, and duplicity. In fact, it's a way of thinking about integrity where actually compromising and selling out simply look like changing one's mind. I've got a new ground project now. At the same time, the Stoics' top-down integrity illuminates something important about what we might grant is genuine unity of a person, rather than the consistent order of a set of preferences that happens to hold. By conceiving of integrity as a property of the virtues, conceiving of integrity as a property of the virtues, however, demands a kind of perfection that is not just rare and difficult, but also, I think, in danger of being demoralizing. So if integrity requires perfection, then no one can really be blamed for lacking it, for being disingenuous or selling out or cooperating with arbitrary power because it's more convenient to do so. Or alternatively, one with this infinite perfection conception of integrity, one implicitly appeals to such a demand for perfection in order precisely to lay blame as a distraction and deflationary device so that the imperfect need not be attended to in any respect. So we might ask ourselves, do we have to choose? Can we cherry pick and take from each of these accounts what we like? Are they even consistent? Is there perhaps some relation between these two? That are each in their own way apt ways of characterizing a valuable unity and wholeness of persons. Now, I'm not going to answer that question directly, but two suggestions that could do with further development. Could these two kinds of integrity and wholeness be related? Plato certainly thought so. The Republic, in effect, argues that the integrity that is a precondition for any meaningful life is the same thing that, when it's pursued to its logical conclusion, is the consummate integrity of a soul fully unified by its appreciation of the perfect integration of the intelligible in the light of the good. Okay. High-flown Platonic words, but if you read the Republic, you see that it's in pursuit of that very same thing that we move from the need for some kind of basic integrity so that life can be meaningful to the sort of perfectly good life of the philosopher. And second, Kant inadvertently draws these two views together in a different way, in a move that I tend to think of as distinctly Platonic, but that's just my prejudiced background. When he claims that orientation in thinking gets its bearings from the highest good. Now, with that in the background, I want to take a fresh start and say, can we look at all these things that look like integrity and clear something of it away and see if we can what we're left with? Does something of integrity begin to shine through? So integrity, I think, if we've got this kind of notion of wholeness, integrity of unity of persons in the background, integrity is not a matter of having principles and sticking to them. Though, of course, the person of integrity will have principles and will stick to them. And integrity is not being unwavering, although much behavior that displays integrity is indeed marked by a noteworthy steadfastness. Integrity is not a matter of having the right values, although the person of integrity will indeed have values that are intelligibly worthwhile to others, even if those others disagree about them. And integrity is not honesty, though the person of integrity will be honest as a matter of course, as well as forthright. It would be more apt to say that the person of integrity is a man of his word, can be relied upon to mean what he says and to take responsibility for following through with whatever actions his words imply. The constancy or steadiness of integrity is the sort that comes from deep self-knowledge. The honesty of integrity is a kind of presence in one's speech and action that stands out and inadvertently calls attention to how most of us are not at all properly present in our words and our deeds. And if the person of integrity has the right values, this is not primarily manifested as unwavering adherence to principles. And this is where the Stoics and Plato, on the one hand, and Bernard Williams, on the other, unexpectedly agree. The constancy and correctness of integrity is more aptly thought of as a constancy of vision, if you like, or perhaps of perspective. It's the unflinching appreciation of which goods are commensurable with which, at which exchange rate, and which are not commensurable at all. And it is the steadfast unwillingness to ever enter into bargaining any amount of the former for the latter. It is unflinching because sober enough to have considered already whether one is prepared to be answerable to these commitments. It is then finally seeing one's field of options and necessities in this light. Seeing the field in this light means, for instance, that some things will show up as options and others do not. So a little tale from Epictetus. Epictetus tells us the story of a Stoic who's advising his friend. The friend's deliberating, shall I go act in the emperor's dramatics? Nero has commanded it and threatened us if we don't do it. And so he asks his Stoic friend, shall I go do it? By all means, says his Stoic friend, go act in the play. And the friend says, well, but why aren't you doing that? And the Stoic says, because I don't even deliberate about the question. For me, it doesn't even arise. And then he says, for he who has once brought himself to deliberate about such matters and to calculate the value of external things comes very near to those who have forgotten their own character. The metaphor of seeing in this light means precisely not engaging with life as if everything were a matter of balancing or choosing or deliberation. This is not, of course, to say that the person of integrity never deliberates, but what they deliberate about, under what conditions, what considerations come into these deliberations, these are different, and they'll not appear as a choice between the prudent and the moral. Once one starts deliberating between the moral and the prudent, one has already lost sight of that unifying perspective and that unity of purpose characteristic of outstanding integrity. And here it's important that the only thing that can serve as the focal point for that unity of purpose is the good itself, or God, depending on which tradition you're working in. The good itself, or God, which we can never know in full and never be confident of knowing correctly, and yet for which we can accept no substitutes. When Plato looks as if he is indulging in the most extravagant metaphysics with his form of the good that is beyond being and better than it, he is in fact just trying to articulate what is so wondrous and so disconcerting about Socrates' goodness. Now, I've described this as perhaps, you know, seeing things in this kind of light, integrity is perhaps a kind of perspective, but I have hesitations about using the word perspective. The metaphor is apt in some respects, and I'll appeal to it again. Perspective takes in whole sets in their relations to each other. And it emphasizes the pervasiveness and mutual coherence of many, so a kind of unity of vision. At the same time, the metaphor carries some particularly inappropriate connotations here. Perspective is something that you can adopt or change at will, both in the literal and the moral sense of adopting a perspective. It may even be fully appropriate to encourage the practice of changing and adopting different perspectives. A perspective implies a point of view, and so implicitly draws attention back to the pinpoint of the isolated, featureless ego that looks out on the world and chooses and acts. Since perspectives are multiple, to think in terms of perspectives is to think in terms of my perspective, which is different from your perspective and yours and yours. Sorry. I think of what I see as mine, as my way of seeing it. And all perspectives are partial in such a way that it cannot be a criticism of a perspective that it is partial. And inasmuch as perspective is tied up in the metaphor of vision, it can imply passivity, or at least neglect of the active engagement of the person. So let's think of integrity as, rather than taking on a perspective, let's think of it as a way of inhabiting the world. It's a way of conducting oneself, of relating oneself, to the world, to others. It's a way of being which at the same time reveals the contours of a world that is more than just a series of episodes and accidents. This will, in one sense, characterize anyone capable of meaningful action and having a life with meaning that is meaningful to that person herself. They will value, and they will be committed to valuing and to the things they value. That commitment will be expressed not just in which options are attractive to that person, but in which options are even conceivable. The integrity that stands out, however, the fearsome Antigone of Antigone, for instance, or the humbling integrity of Job, is not content to live in some world or another. It inhabits and constructs a world around a commitment to appreciating the true value of things and not being deceived or distracted by mere appearances. It's this commitment that determines what could count as a meaningful life and what within a life is meaningful. It determines which options make sense and which arise for consideration at all. But this is where the difficulty comes in. Let integrity be a matter of seeing the world in a true light, or striving to do so, being committed to doing so. Let integrity be a commitment or a striving to maintain that grasp through all one's interactions, activities, emotions, and ambitions. Knowing what matters and what does not, refusing to accept the lesser as commensurable with the greater, let it be characterized as an undistracted commitment to the real weight of things. It's a perspective from which most of the world seems mad, bad, and unutterably sad. Integrity can be a lonely and discouraging business. Now, that is bad enough, perhaps, when we're thinking about whether to recommend integrity to our children, but it gets worse than that. Integrity is a way of being, being oneself, being with others, being in a world, inhabiting a life, but it is also radically at odds with most of the world. It cannot but be so, since the understandings under which one acts and makes sense of oneself and of the world are so different from those that most share. The categories one appeals to, the considerations taken to be relevant, are just orthogonal to those of most people. And this is why Socrates seems so atopos, so strange or out of place. The person of integrity has a way of inhabiting a life, interpreting and presenting it, which does not fit, and this lack of fit antagonizes others. It disrupts the smooth running of things and makes people uncomfortable. Integrity, then, is a dangerous thing. Still worse, let integrity be an ability to keep one's bearings through all the confusions and messiness of life. One keeps one's bearings precisely because one has a steady commitment to what really matters, which, in all its richness, stays reliably as it is, even if one's apprehension of it is always incomplete. This forms the categories through which one sees life and finds the world meaningful. yet one also needs others to keep one sane. It is not enough to be grasping after an elusive good. Other people, how our interactions with them go, whether we find we can make sense to them and them to us, is the ballast that keeps us from listing every which way in the wind. The person of integrity needs those very same people with whom she shares no perspective and to whom she can only, therefore, appear mad. And she needs them in order to stay sane. It's not possible to be committed to valuing things in a true light and to giving things their proper weight, to do justice to how things are, without persisting in trying to inhabit some one world with others. Yet the predicament of the person of integrity is that people who do not already share her commitment are singularly unmotivated to try to see the world from her perspective. And at the same time, she cannot relinquish that perspective in order to find common ground. She can only persist in expressing it and articulating what matters and how things look from there, in the hope of generating some confirmation of her sanity in the form of recognition. And this is why Antigone vehemently rejects Ismene's offer of protection through silence. Speak out. Silent, you will be more hateful to me than if you told everyone. And when the two sisters part, it is with Ismene telling Antigone that it's not possible to do that which Antigone knows is necessary and will be done. Thank you.